Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Episode 6, Using AI Responsibly with Mark Lester.
Welcome back to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching. We have a special guest with us today in the podcast studio, a new guest, someone we haven't had on the podcast before, Mark Lester. Welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm very well this morning, thank you.
Could you tell our listeners about what you do here at Cardiff Met before we get started?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I'm an assistant head librarian in the library services at Cardiff Met. It's part of the wider digital and library services. That's probably not of any interest to your listeners, but it's of interest to me. So my main focus is supporting research and researchers at the university. Nominally, it's a thing called scholarly communications, and I'm glad I got that right, because it's a word I don't often get right. And it essentially is about doing a lot of training, doing a lot of knowledge sharing, talking a lot about open access and open research, and lately as well, talking a lot about AI too.
Which is a nice segue into why we asked you onto the podcast today. Now, those avid listeners will know that we've already done an episode on AI with Carl Jones in our previous season. And we were sort of in that episode thinking a lot about how it's affecting teachers in the classroom, pupils. You delivered, Mark, some really interesting professional learning for us in initial teacher education just recently. And I'm just checking the title because it's important, and it was a good one. It drew me in. It was entitled All Watched Over by Machines That Love Research: What This Means for Research Right Now and What the Future Holds. And having listened to, watched your professional learning, I thought this is going to bring a new angle on this discussion around AI to our listeners. So before we get into that, tell us, in your role, and I suppose personally and professionally, why has AI piqued your interest just lately?
It started piquing my interest around about 2021, when the more aware people were starting to talk about ChatGPT, or the aspect of ChatGPT that we now know of, which is asking a question or putting some information into a box and getting a response. So I started to look into that, and I started to talk to colleagues about it a little bit in the library, that I think this has a huge implications for what we do. And it has huge implications because we offer answers to things, right? We offer a lot of resources, a lot of digital material that students in particular can make use of to do their assignments, get a good grade, et cetera, et cetera. People sort of ignored me for a while, which was good because I was able to go off and have a look at it on my own, find out a little bit more about it, experiment myself. And then suddenly November 2022 happened, and that's when people suddenly started taking notice of, in particular, ChatGPT. And what we now know as large language models, or LLMs. And then I was able to start advocating for us taking a look at this. We formed a community of practice in the library to be taking a look at these tools ourselves. And it's been bared for a little bit of fruit, because we're now being shown products by suppliers and publishers that integrates this technology. And we're able to take a lot more of a critical view on it. So we're not just essentially saying, oh, this is great, here's some money, we'll have it. We're able to do a little bit more of analysis. So we've kind of benefited a lot. And that's where I've come into it, in a sense, because I've always had a little bit of freedom in my role, in my job here, which is good. And I've been able to carve out my own little niche to be a person that knows about these things.
And it's probably worth us nailing our colours to the mast at this point and saying, you know, let's not immediately go down the route of talking about how much we hate AI-generated chunks of essays, how rubbish they are, how incredibly annoying they are to read. Let's start with some positives, because there are some positive applications of AI in terms of being a researcher, but I suppose also thinking about our primary audience of teachers as well. There are some positives. So let's start with the positives. What can you do that's potentially going to make our lives better?
So, I mean, one of the things we focus on in the library quite a lot, and one of the things we're looking at in a lot of detail, is the use of AI to summarise complicated topics, or the complicated topics in this case being very, very long journal articles that people are required to read or encouraged to read as students, but also actually as anybody involved with research is to keep up their own knowledge, their own awareness of what's going on within their topics. So we're focusing quite a bit on some of the positives around that, because we do think it is I do think it's a positive. I think it has a really, really positive impact to cut through a lot of the academic speak. You can potentially read a lot more. You can potentially gain a lot more knowledge of a topic without having to do some of the more fundamental reading. But then additionally, that would be a problem. But I guess we'll get into problems in a bit with some of that. It also can actually aid people in finding information too. I think that's one of the things that we forget about is information literacy within this. And this does actually bring alive information literacy as a topic. For those who don't know what information literacy is essentially how you find stuff online and then how you can interrogate that, bringing in aspects of criticality, verifying your sources from that information, whether it's legit or not. It's like those kind of areas. So it can actually enhance that, in my opinion. And it can also potentially make other aspects of processes quicker for people. But again, there's an aspect of needing to have that base level of knowledge and criticality, which doesn't always exist, as we know.
And I'm curious to know if you've already had students on programmes here at Cardiff Met approach you about this. It's interesting to hear that people didn't want to know at the start, but I anticipate that there were students out there who were sort of in step with you, wanting to know how to stay on the right side of the line of this stuff. What sort of questions have you been getting from students?
I know that a lot of students have been quite keen to make sure that they're still being authentic in what they're doing. So in their writing, they want to make sure that, in a sense, I haven't generated with this AI. I haven't generated what I've done here by using AI. And I want to make sure that that's kind of known, I suppose. So is that questions of, I maybe want to make use of the tool or the tools, but I don't want to be plagiarizing from those tools. How do I do that? And that's a complicated thing. That's quite a complicated line. Because essentially I make a point in other things when I've talked about this, when I said, is it a crime to summarize a journal article? And I've used the meme of that. You might remember back in the day, other listeners may or may not remember, but you wouldn't steal a car that you would get on when we used to get a DVD or a videotape.
Oh yeah,
a VHS.
I do.
You wouldn't steal a car and that kind of. So I make a joke about it to try and introduce the topics to people to say, well, would you summarize a journal article, or would you use AI to summarize a journal article? And that's the sort of ways that I'm trying to talk to people about this topic. But it is fairly an interesting one for me how universities are reacting to it, because some universities are reacting to it in a way of not so much embracing, but they're being very clear about what they're looking for. But I know a lot of universities have just focused just on assessment. And I think probably that's, in my opinion anyway, that's the wrong thing to do. Because these tools are like any other tool that exists. You'd need to talk to your students about it. And if you just talk about it in terms of an assessment, you're going to find a ways around that, aren't you? You're going to find ways that you can bend the assessment rules. And also you're not potentially teaching people about how to actually do these things. So again, going back to information and kind of those digital literacies as well.
Yeah, it's funny mentioning assessment there. I think as you were talking then, I was finding myself wondering, you know, the students are coming to you worried about to commit a crime, you know, steal a car, academically speaking. Thinking about universities, also thinking about schools as well, just sort of thinking generally about teaching, learning and assessment. To what extent do you think the appearance of generative AI is a bit of a reckoning, maybe a bit of an overdue reckoning for our approaches to assessment, our sort of stubborn belief in the gold standard of 1500 words on a page, you know, because I can remember another university being hauled into a meeting, must be 15 years ago, by somebody trying to explain to the assembled mob that we didn't all have to set assessments that were 1500 word essays. This was like rocket science to these people, you know. I've never seen people look so horrified at the idea. To what extent are we actually going down a bit of a blind alley trying to help students navigate this line, given that actually it's quite tempting to just conclude that the whole sort of assessment model really is overdue for a bit of a wash and a brush up?
Well, assessment's about authentication, isn't it? And it authenticates the work that the person has put in, but also the, by extension, the organisation or institution that's offered that degree or qualification, right? So it's a big one, isn't it? I'm not an expert, just to put that. I'm not an expert in terms of assessment. But I would say that, yeah, it should be a reckoning. It should be a way of examining the purpose of writing an essay. What is that doing for that student? Is it providing the thing? Is it providing the learning that they require? Right. Or is it simply because that's a way to operationalise a degree programme?
Cheaply.
Or possibly efficiently, others would say. Not in my position, perhaps more senior people than I would talk about efficiencies and ways to do those. And that's important too, because it is important for the operations of a university, right? Or the operations of a school as well. I mean, you know, I know there's a lot of talk of, there's been a lot of talk in HE in particular about trying to move people towards almost randomised vivas at undergraduate level, which completely blows my mind as how you would do that, and whether that would actually decrease the amount of engagement that you may get from a student and would actually cause more problems than it would actually solve, and whether the return of sitting down within a... examination room, sitting down doing a 2-3 hour exam would also solve the problem. I mean, there's been a lot of talk, I suppose, the differences between England and Wales in particular when it comes to examinations at school level. And then the corresponding, you know, things like PISA and things like that, how that reflects through. Probably needs to look at it. I don't know. I don't have any answers myself, though, obviously. But I would say, I mean, certainly I've got a teenager myself, and they're still doing things that I would have been doing in school. And I was last in school in 2022. No, is that right?
That's 2 years ago.
No. Yeah. 2002.
2002.
Honestly. Yeah. So in 2002, and I did my GCSEs in the year 2000. And that's a long time ago now, as I was reflecting earlier. Surely things have moved on a bit since then, and I would have personally thought that things moved on a bit then. But I've been looking at the assessments they've been doing and the way that they do things, and it doesn't seem to have moved that much on, apart from some of it's on a laptop rather than paper, and that's kind of the only difference.
Let's anticipate that those things are going to change. We are where we are right now, and kind of sticking with this positive spin that Tom mentioned at the start,
attempted
positive spin on the discussion. I was curious and interested about what you said about, you know, one of the areas that you're trying to support students with in terms of the process of learning and preparation that goes into these assignments, even if they are, you know, there are problems with it being too focused on the product. But let's picture a hypothetically engaged, benevolent student that's out there that really wants to get the most out of this process and wants to start using AI to support that process. You mentioned summarising is an area you think that this is got a positive impact on potentially. I remember from the professional learning that you also talked about the process of finding sources to support them. What kind of products, what kind of apps are you pointing them towards, and what are the positive benefits of using those approaches when they're preparing and they're doing that learning in the lead up to their assignments?
Mm. Yeah, so for me, the summarising especially is a really it's a really crucial bit to the academic practice process. I suppose I'm going to use a phrase that some of my other colleagues in the library services use when I talk about academic practice within that. Because we often, if we're talking to students from a library's perspective, we stop short of, we just focus on, say, here's how you find something. We don't then go further, because that's somebody else's job, isn't it, to talk about that. But it sort of is, sort of isn't. So some of these tools do go further. They are about finding, but they also are about that aspect of, give me an understanding of this thing that I've found. Because I've put in some keywords into a search engine, I've gone through some results, I found some stuff. Is this relevant or not? I've no idea. Now, you don't necessarily, as a student, want to read through 50, 60, 70 academic papers. So what these tools can offer is a way to support you in that reading, I suppose. And I suppose that's the positive spin on it. Mm. They're very kind of set up in that sense then for accessibility, right? We want people to come to university in particular, but also within other educational contexts as well, and be supported. And some of these tools can do that supporting as well. There's one in particular that can aid neurodiverse people to just enable themselves to be organised. And there's nothing wrong with that, is there? There shouldn't be problems associated with that. It's just like any other app or piece of software that you may find on the internet and may use it in that way.
Yeah. Thank you. I think we're probably going to have to go there on the potential problems with using some of these tools in this context. But before we do, you painted a really interesting and sort of multifaceted picture of the context that we're in at the moment, and some of the sort of bigger world problems that AI is causing. And they were things that hadn't actually occurred to me when we were having that conversation with Carl Jones, not because he didn't bring them to the fore, but just because they weren't on my radar. And I think it's maybe important for us to highlight some, or for you to highlight some of the things that you started your presentation off with that are real, you know, potential real world problems with AI.
Yeah, so I mean, it's all fun and games until somebody does something really bad. And there's really lovely examples out there of people doing things with an AI, particularly image generating, and it going viral. I pointed towards in my presentation the dripped out Pope that I always use as a nice example, because it's a fairly old example now. Well, it's a fairly old example in terms of the internet. But I think it's about a year and a half old as an example. Is that old or not? I don't know. But it's old in terms of the internet, right? And that's the thing that went fairly viral, because people actually, for a moment, believed that that this current Pope would wear a massive bomber jacket and look pretty cool in it. So that's a nice example. But there's also the potential downsides to those, and that's the downsides of there's been quite recent cases within the American election. One of those being one of the candidates in particular, or one of the candidate's supporters in particular, image generating to be pretty convincing photos that can be shared online and completely false, completely and utterly bring a false narrative. And that's fairly easy to verify, right? That's quite an easy thing to do. But it's the issue is when it goes further down the chain to people, and that's local communities sharing it, right? So that's that sort of aspect of where people could, bad actors could use this technology to share a mock-up of a newspaper, mock-up of a online article, because this is what happens quite a bit within this. We've seen a lot of examples in the last week of this, of where people have shared false information, and it's convincing looking because it's potentially generated as a web page, it's potentially generated as a verifiable link, right? And the verifiable link in the sense of you can click on it and it looks decent, looks good, but it's all completely false and all completely, and people have used generative AI to generate that information, and that's a problem.
Yeah, and we should probably clarify, because this will come out quite a bit later. We're actually recording this as various towns and cities across England are going up in flames in the wake of the Southport stabbings, which has caused a sort of upsurge in disorder fueled by the far right. And as you say, there's a big link to social media and information literacy there, which really does bring the whole thing into focus. I mean, as you say, there's always kind of mildly hilarious examples. I don't know whether mildly hilarious is quite the right word to use, but you know, there's the famous black Nazis, which were generated by, I think, was it Google's AI image generator? You know, people are asking it to generate Nazis, and because they programmed in kind of diversity algorithms, the Nazis came out as black people, that kind of thing. But then looking at the more subtle end, I mean, going all the way back to the point you were making about the ability of AI to summarize an article, am I too tinfoil hatted to be asking, well, whose summary gets summarized, actually? Whose views? I mean, it's a bit like here in the UK, you know, we know that the newspapers generally have a political leaning, the broadcaster's not supposed to. We kind of know in America it's the other way around. Whose view do we get, subtly or unsubtly, when AI summarizes an article for us?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So what should happen? This is one of the things with some of these tools. They're very much black boxes. So the commercial products, for commercial reasons, the companies wouldn't release how they're actually doing some of this work. To clarify, some do, and some are much better, and they provide elements of their code. They provide elements of what data sets they've used within their algorithms. So you can go and look, and plain English as well, not so much in sort of tech speak. But a lot of them don't. In terms of a generative AI model summarizing an article, you wouldn't know why it's picking out certain things. It's picking out certain things that potentially look good in that sense, or potentially would, encourage you to keep using the tool as well in that sense, because you're going to want to, anything that provides a positive response or a positive feedback loop, you're going to want to continue using, as we appreciate from other aspects of social media in particular. There's no clarity there of how it's actually doing it. And then you don't quite know why it's emphasizing certain things. Now, for some topics, that's going to be okay because they're uncontroversial topics. But for most topics that are published in research, they could be considered to be controversial. There's a lot of climate change research. I'm going to use that one as an example. But there could be lots of other research in terms of research into human intelligence, research into any aspects of race, class, gender as well. It's a massive area to worry about, I suppose, in the how it's summarizing that and what it's giving you as the headline points from that piece that it is summarizing for you.
I was quite struck, actually. You demonstrated an app, and I can't remember what it was. You'll probably remember, where you can put in PDF of, I think you used a report, a Welsh government report, it might have been, let's say. And what you're then able to do is to sort of ask questions of that source, and it will summarise it for you. And one of the things that you asked it was, tell me the recommendations from this report. And I think that, let's say that there were 14, it only pulled out like 7. In tandem with Tom's question, the concerns there, you know, how do we sort of develop AI literacy and criticality around it amongst students? And what sort of conversations are you having in the library where people are coming to you with these apps, wanting you to use them, trying to sort of sell them to us, as it were? And you know, are you having to develop your own sort of regulatory framework or decision-making framework about whether you choose to bring them on board or not?
So the UK HE sector does a lot of its thinking and a lot of its negotiations in terms of costs for a body called JISC. So what JISC have been doing at the moment is trying to start to provide not only a kind of national AI centre to help inform HE and FE, actually, in particular, about AI. But then there's the other angle of we're trying to help inform universities in particular of when they're procuring products, what to look for, what to question. But at the moment, it's still quite, it's still a little bit, it's a little bit uneasy out there, or it's a little bit, nobody's quite sure of the legalities around some of this. I make a point in other presentations when I've talked to people about this, that the growth of open access in research has been brilliant for the aspect of people have been able to find stuff and then been able to read it, which is great. But it also is actually feeding the machine in that sense. It's feeding AI. And whether that is legal or not is quite a big debate at the moment. It's quite a live debate at the moment. I'm not a legal scholar. I'm not a lawyer. But in my opinion, a lot of the times the use cases that are coming out are actually perfectly fine in terms of what these companies are doing because of how the work is licensed and made available. But it's not really in the spirit of perhaps how people intended their work to be used, I suppose. And that's an aspect that we're seeing. We're not quite seeing it yet from locally from anybody asking us, but I'm sure conversations are going. I'd love to have more conversations, and we probably will be in the future with anybody who publishes here, how we can talk to them about what the publisher may do with the work as well. There's been, there's been some notable cases of some fairly big academic publishers, I won't name them for obvious reasons, who have licensed their content to pretty big companies, including one of the biggest in the world in Microsoft, to use in their AI technology. And this has caused quite a stir, and hopefully what it will start to do is cause people to have more conversations about this, because in the end it's people's work and people's labour that they've wanted to have published, so they've signed over their rights to a publisher, and that's fair enough because that's part of the deal of getting published, right? But what's happened is their content and their work is now going to be used in a far wider sense that perhaps they didn't fully intend to when they wrote their book or their journal article.
Yeah, and I suppose ethically, because you raise some really important questions about, you know, the climate impact of AI, and there's another dimension there, isn't there? If my work that I've published is suddenly contributing to the climate crisis, then I'm not going to be particularly happy about that. And I wonder, we're as an institution, we've won awards for sustainability. And I wonder, you know, is this sort of setting the cat amongst the pigeons about, you know, on that front as an institution?
It's an extremely live debate, but it's an extremely live debate in the sense of it's been mentioned on some sort of Teams conversation in a thread, or we've mentioned it when we've had meetings and we've been talking about stuff, or just generally having a chat in a coffee shop. What do we do about it? Because it does have, our digital resources alone have a significant environmental impact in terms of what we subscribe to and what those, the environmental impact of having all of that stuff on a server somewhere, or more accurately in a data center somewhere. And this is data centers that are the problem, or potentially the problem, depending on who you talk to. A lot of people see data centers as really important for our economic growth and economic future. Others would say that those data centers are using more water than some towns. And isn't that an issue as well? And then thusly using more energy as well. So it is quite a live debate, and we are very conscious of that when we're talking. Also, when we're trying to talk to suppliers, it's more, your product's nice, but can we see some environmental impact of these? And it's fair to say that I think in most universities, I think they've obviously focused quite naturally on the physical environment in terms of environmental sustainability, but we haven't probably talked too much about what's the digital footprint of what we're doing here, and do we know? Because we probably don't, and it's probably something that we need to be talking about quite actively.
And thinking about that sort of increasing abundance of stuff, I mean, just kind of thinking about it on a simple level about sheer quantity of stuff. I mean, you know, you can play the tiniest academic violin in the whole world if you like, but I've been having real trouble getting stuff published lately because journals seem to have seized up. And speaking to someone recently who runs a journal, he says, well, we're just kind of submerged in rubbish AI generated stuff. We're rejecting 80-90% of the stuff that we get in. It feels like the sort of cogs of knowledge production almost kind of seizing up with the sheer simplicity of producing stuff. As someone whose job it is to help people find the good stuff, how do we actually cope with all of that stuff when actually, you know, think about a lot of the assignments that we see that are generated by AI, using them as an example, a lot of it's pretty rubbish and just getting in the way.
Yeah.
Oh, I've hit on your biggest job problem there, I think, maybe.
If I'm honest, Tom, it's a thing that keeps me, doesn't keep me quite up at night because I'm not that sad, but it does keep me occupied in my thoughts when I'm working, because, you know, we pride ourselves on providing access to good quality resources. But you are right, there's that other aspect of, well, how are those resources being generated? And are they of a sufficient standard to be providing to students? And everyone's relying on everyone else to verify that, which is your point of how it feels, or it's not even feels. The reality is that the peer review aspect to research itself seems to be an issue currently. Well, it's always been an issue historically for lots of different reasons. It's never been speedy, but this is seemingly starting to inundate aspects of what happens. I mean, one of the solutions for me is that the universities reform how they do their work. I mean, massively. Don't use the journal article or where the journal article has been published as a badge of honour. In as much as that's the thing that really matters, because then people would potentially publish less, I suppose. One of the aspects is there's far too much research that is published, and it is true. There's far too much. And it's what has started to lead is not even a steady growth, almost exponential growth of retractions. Retractions being a thing that happens when the research is proved to be either false, fabricated, or somehow problematic. And it's fair to say that that's one of the aspects of having AI or having generative AI available or massively available as it is now, the massification of it, is that it is contaminating what's happening out there, which for me anyway, it decreases the amount of trust that we can have in these sources. And for a university and how it operates in terms of its general teaching and assessment, and how it does its promotions, its aspects of how it talks about its work, there's lots and lots of things to think about.
And thinking about some of our listeners, quite a lot of our listeners who are out in school teaching, and they've got a load of the next generation sitting in front of them. They haven't even come to university yet, these pupils. They haven't started their careers yet. This might be the biggest question of all. I don't know, possibly the most unfair question of all for you. But from a position of someone who deals with knowledge and knowledge literacy and kind of living in a world of information, I suppose we have choices out there in school about what we actually do with that time we've got with our pupils. And once upon a time, I think we taught them facts, we taught them stuff, we taught them how to put that stuff together and then write it down very nicely and to communicate it in that way. It feels like we need to have a little bit of a rethink about what we actually do with that incredibly valuable time that we've got with our young people in school. So from the position of somebody who's going to sort of take them from school and maybe send them off on that next bit of their journey, what do you feel is a priority for what we should actually be doing with young people? Presumably it's not generating big blocks of text.
Yeah. I suppose that's a really good question. Have a think about that for a second.
I'm asking you to be in charge of all education, basically.
I suppose as a father of a 13-year-old, yes, as well.
Yeah, what would you like them to be doing, yeah? What should they be doing?
I wouldn't like them to be doing an example that I will give. And that's when they started in, I won't mention the school, when they started in the school, they were a year seven and they were in a art class and they were researching an artist. So what happened is that all the kids immediately went and Googled the artist's name, which is what I would do, it's what anyone would do. But unfortunately, well, very fortunately for me, it's now become my go-to information literacy example. Because they were researching a particular artist, but every single student, pupil, almost to a person, found a Wikipedia entry for the person that was of an extremely similar name. But it turns out they were, I think, a figure skater. So these pupils had handed in an assignment that had summarized the person's life as an artist, also thinking that the person was also a figure skater. I'm quite happy to say that my daughter figured this out almost immediately and didn't do that. They actually went a bit further and I went, aha, that's what I do. Do you see what you did there? That's what I help people try and, or partly what I help trying people, or what me and my colleagues do, to read around. And be critical in what they're seeing as a first result on a page. And that's only going to be more important to talk to pupils about. And I don't think we should shy away from that. I think a lot of the time, from my perspective, what we do within universities and as librarians in particular, we kind of think students wouldn't be interested in talking to us about this, so we won't do it. What we'll do is we'll just say, here's a big box that you can go and find stuff in. And that's, we've done our job now. I don't want to talk to students about this. No, I won't. They'll just be bored. And of course they will be. Students do get bored by stuff, even if they've come to study at a university. So we shouldn't, I think we've got to double down. And go, and embrace it and go, no, actually this is quite important to talk to you about. Because you're then not going to hand in an assignment that is rubbish. And that's the same for school pupils, right? So at GCSE level, you're not going to do your coursework's not going to be so terrible that when you get to the exam, you're not going to be able to do the exam. You're going to be able to actually get the grade that you deserve, right? And then you're going to be able to move on to A levels or move on to the workplace, whichever route you take. Because, of course, a workplace wouldn't really put up with somebody producing something that was rubbish. So why should a school or why should a university? And it's a very difficult thing to kind of move around, isn't it? Because naturally speaking, as from example of my daughter, everyone would go to where they would be told to go to, which is have a look for it online and see what you can find. And I was aghast at the lack of digital literacy that was being taught within a secondary school. I thought at some point, I didn't mind it in primary school because it's okay. My son is nine and he calls it independent research because that's what they call it. I said, what do you do? Well, we get the Chromebooks out and we have a look at things online. Now he's pretty good at being online. He's been online since, should I admit it? Yeah, he's been online since he's been quite young, but it's always been a supervised thing. And we've always talked to him about what he's looking at and what he's engaging with. So I know myself. It's why I know the trends, because I'm talking to my kids about it all the time. I'm genuinely interested. But I think there's an aspect of it's okay, kids know what they're doing still. And I still see people talking about digital natives and I... nobody is a digital native. I don't, you know, my son, he's grown up, my son and daughter, they've grown up with access to devices, access to the internet their whole lives. They're nowhere near being digital natives. I don't know what people are talking about. No idea. It's a thing I think that older people tell themselves that it's okay because the kids are going to be okay. It's like, it's not about that. There's responsibility, I think, on kind of like my generation, I suppose, now. Say that. Oh, I don't like saying that because I feel like my father. But to be talking to their own children and by extension, any other aspect of where they can talk to people about this if they don't have that ability to just talk to the kids about it.
It's a really interesting point, actually. It's one that gets my goat on a completely different sort of skill set around oracy, that just because in my subject, which is drama, pupils are talking a lot more perhaps than in other subjects, that they're going to be really good at it because they're doing it all the time, just because they've got access to digital technology in all aspects of their lives and from a lot younger, that they'll know how to make good choices about how to use it. And your example was great there, Mark, actually, because we are big advocates in teacher education, particularly in secondary, of secondary subject specialists being teachers of digital competence, but in an authentic way, in a way that enhances what you're trying to do on a subject level. And there's a really great example of, you know, research and artist, but maybe a missed opportunity around the digital skills that would have enabled them to do that really well and to benefit on a subject angle, but also from a digital competence angle.
Yeah, that's it. Because when I was talking to my daughter about it, it sounded like a really interesting artist. And the things that when I was talking about it, that we found and we were... talking about, it was this. There was fantastic. The artist puts their work online. It's all very open. It's all very findable. But she said that her and some of her pupils, fellow pupils, started to be bored almost immediately. And I thought that was such a really disappointing thing to hear, because you were researching an artist who has their work online, and you can take a look at the representation of their work and you can find out all this information about it, but they were just looking to do it as quickly as possible. And I found that a fascinating thing to think about. The use of the digital technology was there, and it was good that they had the use of the digital technology, but there wasn't an aspect of wanting to go into any more depth. It was just a perfunctionary tick box exercise, and
so many consequences for teaching and learning that we unfortunately don't have time to go nope. into in this episode, but perhaps we need a follow-up episode, Mark, down the line as things move on and grow, as inevitably they will.
So yeah, we'll get that repeat performance in the diary before we unseal you from the studio, but in the meantime, let's move on to our infamous homework slots, which I'm pleased to hear we did remember to warn you about in advance. We'll let you pick the order. Something interesting, something to try, either way round. Which is your first one?
I think that within the AI space, I think it would be really interesting for teachers to really try and use some of these tools to do the example I actually showed within the video that I did as part of my role here. Teachers often get told to look at things, don't they? Reports. This has been published, it's very official, it's very important. Use some of these tools to look at these reports. Try out whether it's going to be useful for you or not. I think there's a really interesting angle in this for that summarization. We did talk about problems within some of these tools, but genuinely, if you are using a tool and you are looking at it in the sense of just one source, i.e. a report, you could start to find that it could be quite useful to explore more and then to go into more depth, especially around the aspects of the language that's used within some of these reports in particular, to really then start to engage. Because at the end of the day, things are produced from a policy perspective for the engagement of schools. They are produced in a vacuum, but they are produced in a way to encourage people to make use of them. And that's how some of these tools, I think, people could use.
And interesting that you said to us, resist the urge to be impressed and also act responsibly. I mean, interestingly, we tried an AI tool the other day. Initially, we were very impressed, but actually we became less impressed the more we used it. We started to spot its flaws. What do you mean by act responsibly?
So, yeah, act responsibly. And in that sense of, I wouldn't encourage anybody to use a summary verbatim. I wouldn't encourage anybody to be looking at, always give me a plausible sounding sentence that I'm going to copy and paste it into something else. I would always encourage people to acknowledge what they've used as well within anything that they're doing in this area. The acknowledgement itself, I think, is a good thing because it can encourage conversations with people further. It can encourage a safe space for it too. And I think that's going to be really important going forward. It's going forward in all aspects of using AI within education, providing the spaces for people to use them, to, as you've done, use them and go, I don't actually think that's as good as we thought. And that's important because education technology is a big moneymaker for a lot of places, and it is a big potential thing. I know that, you know, lots of people would be looking at it from the sense of taking workload off, lessening the amount of administration burden that comes with roles and with places, and lessen bureaucracy as well. But it's always going to be important, I think, to keep responsible use going. And then also thinking about the climate is also, just to get that in there.
Anyone out there who's crying out, just tell us what apps you're on about. We're not obviously not marketing these things, but I can reveal some of the ones that you demoed for us. I think ChatPDF was the one.
That was one of using that chatting with a single source. So it's that sense of uploading a PDF and then you can chat with it. And these things, you can find a lot of tools like that. A lot of them are actually, it's one thing I didn't talk about, but a lot of them are freemium. They're freemium in the sense that you can use them up to a point and then you come across a paywall or you come across the fact that you need to log in. I would encourage people to use freemium versions of anything, only because that's a good way to try things out. But be thinking about the aspect of what's the extra money required to access these things as well in terms of that promotion and talking to particularly other teachers about as well. Because I'm sure anybody that listens to this can appreciate, I know there's a lot of education technology in schools. There's a lot of platforms, there's a lot of apps, there's a lot of put up on your phone, get up on your laptop, get the students to put it up on their laptops and phones and use it in that way. So it's a big old area, education technology itself, but I suppose it's that sense of trying things out. There's nothing wrong with trying things out as well.
Actually, yeah, at the risk of backing back into our deep discussion just for a second, this freemium versus sort of paid for, it's not something we talked about in the main discussion, but, you know, if we're concerned about AI sort of burning up the planet so we can make funny pictures of the Pope, you know, I'm almost more worried about the inequality that gets entrenched when some people get the sort of posh AI and some people get the kind of less posh AI, and thinking about academics and thinking about pupils. I mean, we were talking before we started recording about the fact that in some countries, people are getting taught with AI. I mean, there's just somebody sort of supervising them. Well, what if they've only got the free AI? I mean, how worried should we be about that looming inequality coming down the line?
It depends whether the current generation of generative AI goes forward as it is. There's an issue that's happened, again, sorry to refer to things that have happened probably way in the past by the time people maybe listen to this, but just yesterday there was a significant write-off of technology stocks. And those stocks included the usual Apple, Facebook, Meta, all that kind of stuff, Google. But there was an interesting one. There was also a significant write-down of NVIDIA, which are the chip makers. And these are the chips and the transformers that power the computational models that sit behind generative AI. There's a lot of people thinking that this is a bubble. And it could well be. So by the time you listen to this, it might not matter. They've had nearly 25%. It's in the billions of a possibly, actually maybe approaching a trillion. No, anyway, of a write down of their value. So you know, we're talking about these tools as if they may exist going forward. But as we know, technology can come into existence, but also technology can disappear quite quickly. So it's going to be a fascinating thing to see. I think some of these elements of AI are here to stay within education, because I think the applications for education are there in both a commercial sense, well, actually, mostly in the commercial sense, and that's the thing that's to be mindful of. And that's the thing that could potentially still generate those inequalities, because people looking for a quick fix, people looking for you can run that essay that you've done through the, rather than giving it to a tutor, you give it to an AI tutor, the AI tutor is going to give you a mark. Great. That's fascinating. I suppose that's not taught me anything. That's only going to decrease the amount of engagement that you would see within education, because it is literally a tick box exercise then. But then also there's the aspect of those who can afford access to the better AI will have that continued advantage, as you would have if you had more, as you do have in education, if you have more time on your hands, if you don't have to work, if you're in university in further education, and then also if you've got a more settled home life as well, if you are in primary and secondary education, you have more time on your hands to engage with this. You have interested people in your life who are going to talk to you about education and see the value of it. And this could only just, well, it is already happening, but it can, there's a very easy to see scenario where this just continues to pull that apart. And those inequalities that have always been there, those inequalities that we saw during, really very much during COVID and during the pandemic of people not having access to certain devices, places where they could do their learning, that's only going to potentially widen. And that's probably the most worrying thing of it. And that's the thing probably we should be talking about more, how we could potentially use this technology to help, I suppose. But also, again, like I've sort of said, within there, resist the urge to be impressed as well by the technology companies too. They've, not to talk ill of anybody, but they've got very much a particular interest within education, and we should be very mindful of what that is.
I think we've proven how wide-ranging and multifaceted this topic is by setting a precedent of going into deep discussion in a short slot. No, it's great. Hopefully it is for the listeners too. I'm sure it will be. Okay, so something interesting is left, Mark. Anything you've been consuming just lately that's worth mentioning to our listeners?
I mostly have time to consume television. So I've been consuming the show The Bear on Disney Plus. I've only watched up to the second season, but I've been absolutely loving it. I've mostly been enjoying the food aspect to it. For those who don't know, it's based around a restaurant in Chicago. And I've been loving the drama of it. It's absolutely... I tried to watch it with my partner and they said they didn't like it, and I was crushed. It's absolutely like, what do you mean you don't like it? It's really good. They said, yeah, but it's just people shouting at each other in a restaurant. And it is a little bit of that, but that's why I like it. It's very much a bit of sort of comfort food, I suppose, in that sense, or comfort television for me, because it's completely outside of anything that exists in the world in that sense. Is in its own. It exists in the world, but it exists on its own. So that's why I'm loving that at the moment. But I'm doing quite a lot of rewatching. So I'm rewatching a lot of old school HBO shows. So for those who are in the know, The Wire, Sopranos, I'm just completely rewatching those at the moment. But I'm also at the moment at this time of recording, I'm consumed by the Olympics, consumed by it.
Far removed from the genteel world of academia, I was about to say, until I remembered you work in IT.
Plenty of swearing and shouting.
Yes, well, indeed. Yes. Indeed.
No risk of going back down the rabbit hole there. Thank you for those recommendations, Mark. I haven't watched The Bear yet, but I shall endeavour to do that, although it does sit behind another paywall of a subscription to Disney Plus. But
indeed, indeed.
An AI summary.
Yes. All right. Thank you very much, Mark, for joining us.
At all.
And getting in the pain cave to have that deep discussion, some of those things I think we're going to be talking about for decades to come. So thanks for listening. We'll be back with you in 2 weeks' time with another episode. Hopefully you'll join us.
You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duha and Tom Breeze. The special guest this episode was Mark Lester from Cardiff Met's Library Services. Thanks to Mark for joining us in the studio. We have a feeling we'll be asking you back soon. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support from Peter Lambin and Jamie Hicks, and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.